Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassang. In a few days, we will be observing the full moon day for this month, which in our traditional Theravadan calendar is the month of Asala. And as many of you will know, this is the occasion when we remember the Buddha's first discourse, the first occasion that the Buddha delivered his presentation to the world, his realization and liberation on the full moon of the month of what we call May or Vaisakha. Following that, 3 months, he gave his teaching and referred to as the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, which was the beginning of the dispensation of the Buddha. And so this formulation, this is referred to as a sutta, or we translate as discourse, but the etymology of the word sutta, actually it means thread. And the idea behind that is that as a garland of flowers is made up of a thread with these individual flowers on it, so the discourse or the sutta of the Buddha is a connecting thread of perceptions, of concepts aimed at delivering an understanding of what the Buddha himself understood. So the Buddha's liberation was complete and full and irreversible, but then there was the question of how to impart this. When the Buddha was 29 and he encountered the great doubt of what's this all about, this experience of frustration, of disappointment, of suffering, the great doubt that arose and motivated his seeking was, is there a way out of this? And so after many years of searching and ardent practice, he arrived at the realization, which we refer to as his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree and Bodh Gaya. And then, as I said, there's the motivation to share this. It wasn't just a selfish impulse to get out of suffering, but conditioned by aspirations and determinations that the Buddha had made in previous lives. His impulse to liberation was motivated by the wish to benefit all beings. So from the time of his enlightenment in the month of Vaisakha to this month, Asala, it was the enjoying the benefit and the bliss of liberation, but also presumably there was the process of formulating this teaching. And what he came up with and what he delivered was what we know as the Four Noble Truths. And this is what the Buddha said we can do about our predicament. Life is like this. The Buddha and all the great realized beings live in the same world as we do, but the difference between them and us is that they didn't have any suffering. They had pain, they grew old, they got hungry, they experienced frustrating circumstances, but for them there was no suffering, and that's significant. And so all of us, of course, have this interest in what is this realization? What is it that we can do about our predicament, so that we also come to know what the Buddha knew, which is how to live in this world as it is, but without making a problem out of it. How to come to know for ourselves that suffering is not an obligation. pain is part of the package, but whatever it is we do that turns that pain, disappointment, frustration into suffering is an option. And so we're all interested in how to do what we can do to stop that. So that's what the discourse and the Tamacakkappavattana Sutta is about. It's, the Buddha said it's through not knowing two things that we stay stuck in this state of frustration, not knowing suffering, not knowing the cause of suffering. And so in many ways, through the rest of his life, he articulated this process and pointed to and encouraged us to follow the pointing, to follow our interest in freedom, to get to see for ourselves what is it that we're actually doing that makes the problem. The first step in the Four Noble Truths is, again, as you all know, is that there is suffering. And you might think, well, that's fairly obvious, but our addiction to the habits of denial of suffering mean that even though we've got this thing happening all the time and we're always feeling frustrated and let down and disappointed and so on, even though we have this experience, we don't get the message. And so we keep doing it over and over again. So it's relevant that the Buddha made this the first point to contemplate, that there is suffering. In other words, to learn to undo this habit of avoidance, to get free from our addiction of ignoring the reality, which is that we're creating a problem where there really isn't any problem. So to come to admit, yeah, you're not feeling good. Again, it can sound pretty obvious, but often it's the case, usually it's the case, and perhaps for most people it's always the case, that as soon as suffering arises, as soon as you're having a bad time, we try to avoid it. If not by some sort of physical distraction, it's by blaming, projecting responsibility outwards. But what the Buddha wanted us to see was to inhibit that habit and come back and say it's like this. So, yeah, having a bad time. There is suffering. There is disappointment. There is sadness. And not judge it. No judgment. It's like this. So again, remembering the Buddha says, not seeing two things, that we stay stuck in this difficult situation, and not seeing the suffering and not seeing the cause. So the second point is to investigate that. Until we come to see that it's not the pain that's a problem, that's part of what happens if you're born. But there's something else that we're adding to it. And the Buddha, with his clear perspective, his clear seeing, his right view, identified this habit of clinging, of grasping. When agreeable and disagreeable sensations arise, we add to it with this extra activity. We grasp, and in so doing, we complicate it and make a problem out of it. So what can we do about it? Well, certainly this teaching that the Buddha gave, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and by the way, that's only the first two points of the Four Noble Truths, but once you recognize that there is this habit we have of complicating life unnecessarily, we don't want to just believe in it. You can do that. You say the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the turning of the wheel of law, you can make a golden wheel and make wheels out of gold and put them up on the wall and then bow to them. Turn it into some sort of a holy cow. And we Theravadins can be pontificating about the Four Noble Truths, but still be utterly addicted to our habits of avoiding the fact as it arises. So the point of this teaching is to alert us to this predicament, to bring us back to when life is a struggle, what we want to do is get interested in it. Because there is something we can do about it. This is not just something to believe in. It's not just something to hope for. There is hope in it. Yeah, it's very hopeful teaching. It's not a pessimistic teaching. I'm sure all of us would have come across people commenting on Theravadan Buddhism, was going on about suffering, and that's a misappreciation of the Buddha's pointing to this phenomena. In fact, it's a tremendously hopeful and positive message. So what can we do about it? And, well, what we're invited to do is to learn to let go. If clinging is the mistake that we make, then letting go surely is the remedy. And I've been thinking recently about that poster or that picture down in Kusla House that many of you would have seen, with nice photo of Ajahn Chah there with a quote from his teachings that says, if you let go a little, you have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you have complete peace. There's a very attractive, simple logic to that. I'm sure all of us recognize it. It's laying out the path of practice. Again, it's not just something to believe, but this is what we can do. However, if we are not careful, we can, even with this teaching on letting go, turn that into some sort of an idol. And we can be telling ourselves I'm supposed to be letting go all the time. And we can be judging ourselves because we don't know how to let go enough. And we can likewise turn letting go into some sort of a holy cow, something that we idolize rather than using it as a helpful concept to direct our attention in a skillful way. So even this teaching on letting go, which is directly pointing to what we can do, we do need to be careful about. Because if we look more closely at experiences that we've perhaps had of letting go, if we're honest about it, then maybe you come to see that letting go also is not something that we do, it's something that happens. We don't do letting go. Letting go happens. So we need to be subtle about this. The encouragement we have in training and attention and carefulness and watchfulness, so as we don't just, again, even the teachings, the Buddha and the great teachers, even these are not just something that we grasp at, but they're something that we learn to apply. So not, even though we have the teaching that grasping is the cause of our suffering, we'd like to be free from this habit, and that letting go is the way out, but paying attention to what brings about the letting go. Not just, as I said, not just clinging, well, I've got to become somebody who's letting go. That's what it means to be a Theravadan Buddhist. This is what it means to be a disciple of Ajahn Chah, somebody who's practicing letting go. And perhaps if you've read some of the teachings of Ajahn Chah, you would have come across examples where he's pointed out the unwise letting go. I think he calls it the letting go of a water buffalo. He's referring to a monk who was sitting in his hut there, and the straw roof had caved in, and the monk is sitting there, and all his robes and his possessions are all wet from the rain, and Ajahn Chah, doing one of his inspections of the monastery, checking up on his monks, and he sees this disciple sitting there meditating, all drenched in the rain, and he asks him what he's doing. He said he's doing letting go. And Ajahn Chah points out that's the letting go of a water buffalo. That's not very wise. If you idealize letting go, then you can end up doing that. And trying to be somebody, trying to become somebody. And the becoming, as the Buddha pointed out, is not the way. Becoming is suffering. Even becoming wise. Another of the well-known quotes from Ajahn Chah's teaching, where he points out, he says, don't be an arahant, don't be a bodhisattva. If you're anything at all, you're going to suffer. Again, a skillful pointing to, don't simply grasp at the idea of doing a technique, of becoming somebody. Our attention needs to be much more subtle than that. So if we have this teaching from the Buddha and the great teachers pointing to our habit of avoiding suffering and hopefully getting a little deeper and more subtle and seeing beyond that, the question is, well, what can we do? How do we go about this? And again, the Buddha was very, very clear, very specific in inviting us to investigate the consequences of clinging. Because this is when letting go happens. If we want to know how to generate the conditions for bringing about letting go, it's to observe the consequences of clinging. Not idealize letting go and trying to do it, trying to imitate it, but being acute enough in our awareness, being present enough with our mindfulness, having slowed down enough and followed the heart's native impulse to be free from suffering, rather than following what's going on in our head, idealizing about how we should be if we want to become enlightened or become wise or be a good Buddhist or something. Yeah. Rather following the instinct and interest that comes from that to be free from suffering. Then in the moment when we are suffering, we stop and look at it. Yeah. And in so doing, understanding arises, or there's a chance that understanding will arise. If we just cling to the concept of not clinging, we're just clinging. Yeah. I was talking to somebody earlier today, an abbot of another one of our monasteries, and he was saying how this young fellow had come to visit the monastery and he had a good experience there and it was very encouraging for him, and which the abbot gave him a book that was printed by the monastery, and this young chap was very happy to receive it, but then when he left, he gave it back to the teacher. He said, oh, I really like this book and I've had a really good experience here, but I'm afraid I might become attached to it, and so I don't want to take it with me, I'll give it back to you. Well, if we're afraid of becoming attached, if we're afraid of suffering, that's just another symptom of our habit or our addiction to avoiding suffering. What we need to do is get more honest about it. We establish the parameters of our practice, the parameters of our behavior, by keeping the five precepts. We can live within the five or the eight or the 10 or the 227 precepts, whatever our vocation might be. So that defines the activity of body and speech. And then within that, we welcome suffering. You don't want to get carried away and say, bring it on, that's a little inflated, but not following our tendencies to avoid suffering. Yeah. If we're interested in this facility exemplified by the great teachers like Ajahn Chah, letting go, if we're interested in that, not just letting go a little, but letting go a lot, and potentially letting go completely, if we're interested in that, we want to see the consequences of our clinging. Really welcome the consequences of our clinging. And then contemplate it. There's the cause, and here's the effect. And that's when letting go happens. And similar to the pain we experience in the body, it's a message. You stub your toe, and you have that particular form of nervous disorder where you don't register any pain, and you don't pay attention to the damage that's been caused, and who knows what sort of infection or even eventually maybe gangrene sets in and you lose part of your limb. because we didn't heed the message. The pain is a message saying, pay attention. But if we don't have a good education, we don't understand accurately, then we judge the pain and saying, this is a pity, this is unfortunate. You know, talking about emotional pain here, pain in our hearts and in our minds, that when we feel sad, disappointed, disillusioned, let down, we simply judge it and distract ourselves. And that's the opposite of practice. So the letting go that we can admire and aspire towards is not something that we do. It may be the characteristic of freedom, a path of practice, but it's something that happens. Or as Ajahn Abhinanda points out, it's an accident. You're talking about being freed from the habit of clinging and grasping, it's something that happens, just similar to the way an accident happens. But as Ajahn Abhidanda points out, you can make yourself accident prone. There are conditions that we can generate, like, for instance, getting interested in the consequences of our clinging, our habits of clinging. We can contemplate letting go in terms of a little, a lot, or completely. And it's like, in a way, it's like contemplating the quantity of letting go. But it can also be useful, very useful, to consider the quality of letting go. It seems to be that for some people, their practice is a series of lots of little letting goes and incremental increases in faith and familiarity with the path of practice of letting go and increased well-being and understanding. And yet it seems that there are others whose practice is more characterized by big letting goes, not lots of little letting goes, but big letting goes that sometimes, for some people, just seem to happen. You know, they may happen in the context of a retreat or in keeping the company of some great being, or maybe it just happens spontaneously in the middle of nowhere in particular, but it does seem to be that some people experience these big letting goes or deep letting goes that totally turn their world upside down. And it is helpful to appreciate that when teachers teach from their experience, they are sometimes talking about different types of letting go. Now, somebody, for instance, whose practice is characterized by a whole series of lots of little letting goes, may be particularly skilled in teaching various techniques in practice, developing skillful means. And it's probably got the flavor of being goal-oriented. Maybe it feels a bit like somebody who thinks they never have enough money in the bank. They're always trying to get more. They're always studying more, developing more, going on more retreats, listening to more teachings. But for somebody who's experienced a big letting go, the kind of letting go that introduces them to a fundamentally different perspective on reality, the flavor of their teaching may be more like somebody who has a sense that there's plenty of money in the bank, they just need to be concerned about how to spend it or how to access it. They're not possessed of a view of lacking, always needing to get more, and always developing and going somewhere and seeking more teachings and teachers and techniques and so on. And maybe one could call that sort of practice source-oriented. It is an intuitive appreciation for what's always there. Yeah, their teaching or their practice might appear like they have lost access to their bank account. Maybe they've forgotten their password. Yeah. But there's still the sense that the resources are there. Yeah. Somebody whose practice is an effort to develop lots of skillful means and build up their ability and intentionally cultivate an increase in faith, they can get confused by the teachings from somebody who is coming from a different perspective, and maybe it's not even helpful for them. And similarly, somebody who's experienced the kind of letting go which has relativized all experience, perception that relativizes all conditions and personality and all aspects of personality, and somebody teaching from that perspective can end up causing a lot of confusion for people. In our investigation of what it is we can actually do about this predicament of creating suffering when there really isn't any suffering, in creating problems when problems don't actually exist, it's skillful to stop and consider not just the amount of effort we put into letting go, but also the quality of letting go. In both cases, whether it's small letting goes or big letting goes that we're dealing with, in both cases, surely it's increasing capacity for trusting that we want to see. Mm-hmm. And trusting is not something that we can figure out with our head. We can try. But when I describe this aspect of practice, I refer people to the experience of learning to float if you're swimming in the sea. How do you float on the water? Is it something you learn by trying? There's a certain way of trusting that means you're still going to sink. You're trying to trust, and somehow it doesn't do it, doesn't work, and you still sink. But maybe you've had the experience that there's another way of trusting whereby you just float on the surface. How do you do that? Well, it's certainly not through concepts. So whatever sort of letting go, whether it's a series of small letting goes at feeding and nourishing our increased faith, or whether it's some sort of big letting go that has turned our world upside down and we're trying to recover from it and integrate that perception to the rest of our lives, whatever it is, the way to build on it, I would suggest, is through emphasizing the cultivation of trust. Yeah. In either case, we're not dismissing the place of effort, we're not dismissing the place of will, but we're not prioritizing trying and willfulness. We're prioritizing trusting, a special sort of trusting, as I was saying. It's not something we learn from reading books, but it is something that we can grow in. When somebody asked one of the Buddha's chief disciples, the Venerable Sariputta, What are the conditions for cultivating right view or clear seeing? And then Sariputta pointed out that there's two conditions. One is wise reflection, which we talked about. When you're suffering, not just distracting ourselves and avoiding the conflict, but stopping, getting really interested and considering it wisely, looking for the cause. And so wisely reflecting. And the other condition that also he put a pointer to was listening to those who know what they're talking about, or spending time with those who know for themselves the practice of letting go. Associating with the wise, as the Buddha put it. And so it does seem to be that there is something we can do about our predicament, but probably it's going to be most helpful if we don't get too serious about it. So thank you very much this evening for your attention.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.